Welcome to Follow Your Kind podcast, a show where we explore the meaning of kindness and how we can express it in our daily lives. My name is Christina and I'm your host. Okay, today's conversation is very special. Jackie Merritt is a remarkable human being. She's a physical therapist and biomechanist, and she has a PhD in neuroscience. She's also an endurance runner who completed 4 100-mile races so far. Last year, she has finished 7th female in Western States 100-mile endurance run, which is the oldest 100-mile run. And she has done it all on a plant-based vegan diet. So I cannot be more excited about this conversation. Welcome to another episode of Follow Your Kind podcast. And today on the show, we have Jackie Merritt. And I'm really, really excited to talk to her because there's so many areas that I'm interested in that she does. And she doesn't just do it a little bit. It's like anything that she does, she reaches the top. And she really goes into the detail and she really takes it to the extreme, and she achieves a lot in each of the areas that she participates in. So I'm really excited about the conversation. Welcome, Jackie.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So let's start by diving in into your vegan story. Tell us how and when did the change happen and what led you to that?
Yeah, sure. So I grew up in Maryland, lived with my parents and my brothers. And we were very much raised a meat and potatoes family. You know, my cousins like to say I live on a farm. We had, you know, horses. We didn't have like livestock or anything. But yeah, it was very much, you know, standard American diet, I would consider it. When I got to college, I started becoming a little more health food conscious, but not like vegetarian or vegan or anything. And then when I got to grad school, I got more interested in running, and I started following Scott Jurek, who is a famous ultra runner, if you don't know who he is. And he is also vegan, and I remember very distinctly, I started following him on social media, and one day he posted that something about the China study, the book, and that this book, after he read it, had really changed his life. Mm-hmm. And that's a pretty profound thing for someone to say, and it really compelled me to buy the book and read it. And so I read the China study, and that was pretty much, you know, a couple chapters into that when I went out and I cleaned my fridge out, and yeah, I was committed to plant-based. And that was about 8.5 years ago or so. So I've been plant-based pretty much ever since then. I've been loving it, feel great, love cooking. I'm plant-based. Cooking got so much easier and more enjoyable, and my grocery bill got a lot less expensive as well. So those were all added benefits to the health benefits of the plant-based diet. But I think the China study really spoke to me because it, if you haven't read it, it comes from a really scientific approach, and it really talks a lot about research, you know, from the animal research with the, you know, lab rats and the cages, and, you know, very, experimental work, benchside, to, you know, the epidemiologic human studies, and the science is just so compelling. I was really shocked that I had not heard of this stuff before, and being, you know, so interested in science, going all through college and, you know, being in grad school, that I hadn't heard of this research before. It was crazy to me. So that was pretty much the day that, the day I bought China Study, the day I read the first couple chapters, was the day that I went plant-based. And yeah,
that's really cool. What was the track for your education at that point? You mentioned you were in grad school. What were you going for education-wise?
Yeah, so I went to undergraduate. I think my undergraduate degree is in health science, and I was pre-physical therapy. And I started physical therapy school at the University of Delaware, and I also started a simultaneous PhD degree in, what was my, in biomechanics and movement science is what my PhD is in.
Can we just take a second for acknowledging the education level that you already have? This is really amazing. Yeah. And how did, so after reading China study, other than making changes in your own life and in your own diet, did it also somewhat change the approach to how you were taking in the information that you were getting in with your the official education within the school format?
It definitely made me question more, like, some of, like, the government-recommended guidelines, and really, like, these are usually sources that you feel like you can trust without, I don't know, doing all the digging into mm-hmm. the data and the background research, but that, I guess, really delving into the literature made me realize that that's not always the case, and I think that the best thing that you can do is to, you know, you should be critical of things that may not make sense, and you should, you know, educate yourself and look into it yourself and read the data, look at the data, and decide, you know, make your own decision. And that was basically what I did, and that was kind of what the China study kind of really kind of triggered for me. So I guess in that sense, yeah. But I've always been pretty, I've had a pretty inquisitive mind. Like in PT school, I was the person asking, why are we doing 3 sets of 10? Why aren't we doing 3 sets of 8 of this exercise? You know, like that type of thing. And so, yeah, I've always kind of been, had that kind of approach to education.
This is really cool, and this is really interesting. I think what stands out for me is that, the first of all, the approach of kind of never stop questioning and not taking for granted the things, or not taking as given, rather, the information that is being fed to you. And I would imagine as somebody who was in school for getting your doctorate degree, you were coming across of some profound information with some pretty important names of the authors, but still, you know, still never kind of living that perspective of just always doing a double check if it makes sense, if it's logical, what are the alternatives of the view of that. I think it's really important.
Yeah, definitely. And I think in my clinical doctoral degree, like in PT school, it was a little less common, but when you start hanging out with people getting a PhD, everyone's questioning everything everyone does, and we're all very critical of each other and all the research out there. And that was, I love that environment. I mean, it can be a little cutthroat sometimes, mm-hmm. but I just really love that, like really challenging each other, challenging our decisions really. And really ultimately in my research and research my colleagues are doing, we're ultimately just trying to improve the lives of people. And so I think that is just a really, you know, that the environment that academia sets mm-hmm. up for that is really what you need in order to mm-hmm. to optimize, you know, in my case, rehab or medicine or whatever it is. So yeah, I think I had a healthy balance of, okay, this is like the clinical training, and then this is like more of the research approach, and it really has helped, you know, me translate some of my work as well. So
that's really cool. And so tell me, maybe for the listeners, and I think maybe most of the people would be aware of the China study and what it is and kind of what the main conclusions are, but maybe for somebody who's not, or for somebody who thinks that China study might be a little too much of an academic of a read for some mm-hmm. people, maybe too scientific of like a casual read on the Sunday evening, could you give yeah. them just like a brief conclusion of as somebody who has a doctorate degree, could you give the listeners just an overview of conclusion of what China study shows and the research that's in there?
Yeah, definitely. Well, firstly, I would say it would be impossible to summarize everything in a couple sentences, and that you should be questioning me. You should not take my word for it. You should really go out and read it yourself so that you really fully understand. You know, I would never personally be satisfied with someone just telling me, oh, eat plants. But basically the conclusion is that you know, a plant-based diet as close to 100% plant-based and really whole foods plant-based, we're talking about, you know, stuff that grows out of the ground. The more stuff that you eat that grows out of the ground, the better health outcomes you will have or that you're predicted to have. You know, they have, it breaks it down into, you know, different health aspects in relation to a whole foods plant-based diet. So they have a chapter on, you know, cancer and those, that research and how, and they really break it down and get into like, you know, cellular, molecular-based stuff, but they also, I mean, it's, I'm a scientist and I have that kind of perspective, so I always wanted them to get more technical, and then I know some people have told me, whoa, that book was, like, pretty technical, but it was really interesting, so I think that Campbell does a really good job of kind of balancing that, but yeah, they talk about, you know, nutrition, autoimmune, gosh, it's been a while since I've read it, so now I'm, like, kind of blanking on what all the chapters are and how they kind of break it down, but that's kind of how they break it down. But yeah, the bottom line is that the closer you can get to 100% whole foods plant-based diet, the better health outcomes are associated with that diet. You know, but you know, a couple of other points I think are important that the book makes that I really appreciated, especially as someone, you know, 8.5 years ago, whenever I made the change myself. Was newly adopting it, was that, you know, if you have, like, order a salad and they have, like, cheese on it and you, like, scrape it off, and but you get, like, you know, a tiny amount of that cheese in your system, it's not going to, like, totally ruin you. It's not going to be completely detrimental to your health. We're talking about, like, what are you doing the other 99% of the time? And right. I think that that was kind of important for me as well, because sometimes it is hard. Like if I travel home to, you know, Maryland and I'm in the middle of nowhere in rural Maryland and I can't, you know, it's hard for me to find anything but a salad sometimes. And sometimes they will slip up in my order and put like a little bit of cheese or maybe like, I don't know, something I ate had like a little bit of like milk base in the dressing or something like that. That it wasn't like the end of the world and I'm not going to get cancer now or something, but right. It's really like those decisions that you're making independently every single day, what you're doing that 99.9% of the time. So I think that was also an important point in the book that he did a good job of making that I really appreciated as well. Mm-hmm. So
that's really cool. No, yeah. I agree. I think one of the things, and I remember reading that book, it was one of the big game changers for me as well in the my education towards the plant-based diet. It's reading the China study. It's one of the first really serious books I read. And I think the thing that stood out for me, the fact that stood out for me the most, or maybe the study that he highlights, is the how they were, through the studies of lab rats, as you mentioned, they were able to literally turn the cancer growth on and off through the amount of animal protein that they were feeding the rats. I mean, once you see that, it is literally like a light switch. And to kind of to ignore that data afterwards, I just couldn't. So it's one of those things that I say there are things that you just cannot unlearn. And for me, that just understanding that process, how the intake of animal protein affects our health and the processes that happen in the body, I think that was something that I just could not
exactly,
unlearn
yeah.
from the health perspective.
And it's never too late, right?
Exactly.
You know, like I'm telling my parents, like, hey, you guys could still make this change, you know? They haven't jumped on it yet, but yeah.
Well, we never know.
If I get them to read the China study, they might. I don't know.
Sounds good. Yeah. And so what was your transition like? So you said it was pretty much like a clean slate. You cleaned out your fridge and you went.
I know a lot of people. Yeah, a lot of people talk about like a gradual transition. I literally went into my fridge. I had like some frozen chicken breast and like some like I think Parmesan cheese. I literally just like threw that out and never ate it again. It was that simple for me. I mean, also like my scenario was I was a graduate student living you know, by myself with one roommate, and like I did all my own grocery shopping. Mm-hmm. I did all my own like meal prep. Like I didn't have anyone else that was influencing my food decisions, mm-hmm. other than myself. So it was very easy for me to just decide I'm not eating this anymore, and then just never eat it again. And like I said, cooking got a lot easier for me. I started, you know, being more like experimental, exploring more cooking, and I learned so much and how to use like spices and everything got more flavorful, and it was just an amazing experience. I started running a lot faster, which was also really awesome because, you know, what runner doesn't want to start running faster? You know, just changing what you're eating. It's not like I'm investing any more time or in training or anything. So
I think this is a perfect transition. So let's talk about running, because this is another huge area of your life and community and achievement. So let's maybe take a step back just a little bit to kind of where your running career started, and then fold it back in with how the transition to plant-based diet and veganism kind of enhanced that or affected that anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you want me to start, like, describe what I run currently, how I kind of started running?
How did it start?
Okay.
And we'll take into all of your crazy, amazing running achievements.
Yeah, so I started running when I was in undergraduate at James Madison University. I did not run in high school or college. I had a basketball background, so I played basketball, mm-hmm. you know, all through you know, grade school and high school. And then in college, I wasn't very involved in sports in the first couple of years. Then I joined triathlon club at JMU my junior year. And that kind of got me involved in, like, you know, more regimented training, and then hanging out with all these like-minded people that were very interested in like health and fitness and physical activity. And I just loved like being part of that team again. Mm-hmm. And, you know, of course running is part of the triathlon. And I quickly found that I was really good at the running part. I did okay biking and swimming, I got by, but, I really excelled more at the running part, and the longer the distance running, I tended to do better. And so triathlons kind of led to dabbling in some road races, which seemingly quickly led to me signing up for a 50-mile race, because it was this 50-mile race was a very special race. It was a race that starts in my hometown where I grew up, like my entire life in Boonesboro, Maryland. It's called the JFK 50-miler. It's been going on since long before I was born. I think it's in its like 50-some year running. And I just, you know, it was part of my childhood growing up. Every year we'd like see in the newspaper the lead up to the race, and then you could go like watch the race and all these crazy people. And that's what it was. It's kind of like these people are insane. Like, who would want to do that? Who would willfully want to cover 50 miles? And you would see them and they would look like horrible, you know, like at mile 40 something, you're like, how is this even happening? So anyway,
who would want to do that? Who
yeah,
would want to torture
exactly.
themselves that way?
Well, apparently I did. I thought I could do it after I started running and doing triathlons, and I did like a marathon, and that seemed really far. So I don't know what possessed me, but I signed up for this 50 miler, and yeah, I did the 50 miler, and then I guess the rest is history. Really, I mean, I got involved in the trail running community, we were talking a little bit before, and that really, when I started training and running with people in the trail running community, it was, it became my new social network. Mm-hmm. Like, they were my friends and my new friends and family. Like, I spent time with them, you know, when I wasn't in school, that's where I would be. I'd be running, I'd be training, I'd be hanging out with these people. That was who I was. It really kind of became part of my identity, really. And I just loved it. And I loved being outside and in the woods again. And really that just spiraled into ultra trail running and 50 miles and beyond.
So just so everybody understands what is happening here, can you highlight how long, like, because we were just talking about it right before we started recording, how long it took before you started running until your first half marathon, until your first full marathon, and then 50 miler?
Yeah.
Because it literally took what, like 10 days between all of those?
Oh gosh, yeah. And this is not how I would recommend people to
approach
this, to approach this progression, but I started triathlon like my junior year of college, and then probably about a year or so later, I had run like my first half marathon, and I didn't think that was that hard in terms of like just the distance, covering the distance alone. And so about 6 weeks after that, I ran my first full marathon, and that was far. Yeah, that was really far. Like, I was like, oh my gosh, like, that was really painful. That was, you know, a bucket list experience. I'm not doing that again. And then I think like 2 months later, I think I was running again, and I signed up for the 50 miler because
it's insane.
Yeah. So I think what really triggered me to do that was I was like running with this one of my friends who is like my training partner at home, and he did this 50 miler every year, and I was faster than him and I was stronger than him at like pretty much every run and every bike ride and everything we were doing. And he just would never stop talking about JFK 50 miler and how it changed his life. I don't know. When someone tells me something changes their life and I like respect them as a person, it's pretty compelling to me. Like, I want to explore that. And him, you know, talking about this race and how much it changed him, really, and then me, of course, like, getting these confidence boosts, like, every time we worked out together, like, well, if he can do it, I can probably do it, and so, yeah, I think that's probably why I signed up for it, because it was really, probably, he largely influenced me to do that.
This is really cool. It was, as I was preparing for the interview, that's kind of one, I was very curious exploring that with you, as what was driving you, what is driving you to do this crazy endurance runs? Because as you mentioned, like the first time you ran your first full marathon, you said it was a bucket list experience, and then you were ready to get done with it. But then 2 months later, you sign up for something else, right? But then at the same time, it seems like, as you said, the changed my life experience is a recurring theme for you. So when Scott Jurek shares something that changed his life, that was a vegan diet or a plant-based diet, and you're willing to take a leap of faith and explore that. And then when your friend shares about the 50K, the JFK 50K, share a change in his life, you're willing to explore that as well. So that's really interesting. What is it what is it that makes you do that? Is that the faith? The trust or respect for those people and want to explore
it for yourself? I think it is like trust and respect for the person who's like saying this. And then, I mean, like, that's something that I don't say lightly myself. Like, there aren't many things in my life that I can say this moment, this one thing, you know, JFK 50 mile, this one day, or the China study, this one book changed my life like profoundly. Mm-hmm. It's just like a pretty strong statement, and it just makes me curious. Like, I want to explore that, you know, like, I want to explore that experience that had that effect on you. I'm just curious about it. So
I love it. So it seems like from some of the values or some of the things that drive you in your life, curiosity seems to be a large component, because before you also mentioned that you're a very inquisitive person. So it seems like that folds into that as well.
Yeah, I'm a very curious person.
Wow.
Yeah.
I don't think I've heard anybody who is driven to run 100 miles because they're curious.
The 100 miler, is definitely, even within the ultra running mecca, is definitely a different animal. Like, than a 50 miler, than a 100 kilometer. That was definitely like triggered by a curiosity, but I did wait a few years to do the 100 miler distance, which I'm very happy that I waited.
So that's the Western states we're talking about, right? Or there was another 100 miler.
I've done 400 milers. So I honestly, like, in terms of ultra runners, like, that's like not that many. Some people have many, many more than that. So Western states is my most recent one. Yeah. And, I had done 3 before that. So
what was it like? What were the harder ones? Or would you say the Western States was the highlight of all of them, or not necessarily?
Western States was definitely the highlight, just because Western States, how do you even describe it? So it's like, in ultra running, Western States is kind of like the Super Bowl of ultra running. is just like so competitive. There's so many people there and there's such a large like crowd and support and tradition, and it's just it's hard to describe, but it's just very, yeah, it's like the Super Bowl of ultra running. And it was just an amazing experience to get to go to California and do that. It's hard to get into as well, so that's part of getting there.
And I don't know much about the 100 milers yet, should I say. But from what I'm
thinking
gathered,
about doing one now.
Well, I wanted, my next goal is to do a full marathon. So I'm feeling that after this conversation, I might commit to one this year. We'll see. But so that from what I was able to find, the Western States is also, it's the oldest 100 miler there is. Is it in America or in nation, I mean, worldwide?
I want to say it is the oldest 100 miler in the world. Yeah, because it started as a horse race, actually. People would race their horses 100 miles.
Well, that sounds a little easier than running.
Yeah, it does. But and actually, now a human can run it faster than a horse, much faster. So it is really interesting how it's evolved. But yeah, so the story behind Western States is that it started as a horse race, and it was like, you know, I don't know how long it was going on as a horse race. It still actually is a horse race, but the running race is like more like well known, at least from my perspective, it is. But the story of how Western States became a human foot race is that this guy's like horse became lame or sick or something, and the horse couldn't run the race. So the guy just decided to do the race, and he did it. He did the whole thing. And people didn't think he was going to make it, but he beat a lot of the horses when he did it too. And so that's basically how Western States started. And I don't know all of the details of the story, but I'm pretty sure that guy is the guy that his name Gordy. He still runs the race, or he starts it every year, and he's like, I don't know, 70s or something.
Wow.
I'm not sure how old he is, but it is a pretty fun story. Yeah, it's pretty interesting how far we've come. Like, this guy's still alive, you know? And it's so fascinating how far we've come to thinking, like, 100 miles, like, there's no way a human could cover that. And now people are doing, like, 400-mile races on foot. You know, like, there's just, like, it just defied, like, what we thought the human body was capable of. And we still are, you know, I think.
Mm-hmm.
You know, really pushing those boundaries and everything, and it's really exciting. So,
yeah. Well, that's really cool. Isn't there? I remember I listened to some podcast. I think it was maybe the Human Brain or something, and it was talking about how a lot of it is also in our minds, and there are like certain distances where like we thought it was impossible to break a certain time. But then once, like, for example, 6 minutes, but then, for example, once somebody is able to do it in less than 6 minutes, then all of a sudden it's, like, broken five consecutive times in a row just because now people think it's possible. And then we just continue improving. And I find this just breathtaking, the how, like, it's mind over matter.
Yeah, we absolutely set a lot of our own limitations inside ourselves. And I just love, like, really kind of, like, pushing myself and like asking and, you know, challenging, like, what are you capable of? You know, I remember standing at the starting line of my first 100 mile race and being like, I don't know if I'm going to finish this race. Like, I could fail this race. And I think that we really need to kind of step outside our comfort zones and challenge ourselves to do things that there's a good chance that we will fail, but, you know, that's really where you grow and where you learn a lot more about yourself is when you're really at your limits, whether this is, we're talking about running, whether it's talking about, like, you know, just achieving your goals and like pushing yourself to like what you want to accomplish in life, really. So
endurance sports is so profound. I mean, the longest that I've done so far is 15 miles, but I'm shooting for more this year. But I think, and I also love how Rich Roll talks about that, is that the endurance running, when you run these crazy races, it strips you down to your very just basic, bare human humanness, as bare as it gets. And it's about humility, and it's about learning who you are at your very, very core. Because I imagine it just becomes so real, and it's like you have to be present and mindful in the moment where you're at. There is no other way, because every second you can stop or you can go.
Yeah, absolutely. Every step sometimes on an ultra, it's like, you know, a decision, like just to keep moving forward. I really love like just being in that like dark place in your mind. Like, you know, where does your mind go when things start getting hard? Like, what does that voice in your head start saying? Like, you can kind of like dissociate yourself from that and just take it in as like information. Like, I don't know, the whole experience is just like really fascinating to me. And like so much of ultra running, especially like something like a 100-miler, I mean, you're out there all night, you know, like all day, all night. It's like, how do you troubleshoot this? How do you troubleshoot something that like you weren't expecting to happen? Like It's mile 60 and I'm like in the bushes vomiting right now. I wasn't expecting that to happen, but like, what am I going to do about it? Like, am I going to give up? Am I going to figure out how to make this work and keep moving forward and get over it? And a lot of times you will start feeling better and you will get over it. And when you didn't think you could. So it's just, yeah, I love it. I love ultra running. I love, the community with it. I love, everything
This is incredible. And to listeners, Jackie's speaking about this whole experience and about vomiting in the bushes on mile 60 with a smile on her face. So I think just that is incredible.
I wasn't smiling then, but looking back on it, I'm like fondly looking back, like, I got through that moment. That was good.
So would you say Western States was one of the highlights of your running career so far, the endurance running career, or was there a different race that stands out to you in that regard?
Yeah, Western, I mean, I've had a few highlights looking back, like personally. Western States was definitely one of them, just because that kind of like, I don't know, that got like the most attention because it's so competitive and prestigious, and like the whole world is like literally watching you, and everyone's kind of like competing for a top 10 spot, at least like if you're kind of like competitively racing. And so I was able to get one of those last year.
Finished the seventh female.
Yeah,
correct?
I finished seventh.
That's amazing. What was it, 21 hours?
Yeah, 21 hours. It was quite the year too. I mean, we had snow to get through and like, you know, ankle sucking mud at the beginning. And then we had like 110 degree heat in the canyon. So you just like got out of the snow and then you just like baked all day. And then I was in like 20 something place, at mile like 20 and 30 or something, and then I basically like spent the rest of the race just like picking my way back up, and I ended up finishing in seventh woman. So I was very determined and just kept sticking with the plan and didn't really let my position at that moment like derail me into thinking like I should be running faster, because like mile 30 is not that far when you're racing 100 miles, you know, like it doesn't count yet at mile 30. So,
oh my God, that was, imagine that.
Yeah, that was definitely, it was definitely a fun experience. But you know, that, I got to Western States. I won an entry at the Georgia Death Race, which is actually, you know, right up in North Georgia. If any of your listeners are looking for, an ultra, a very hard mountainous ultra to do. Georgia Death Race is definitely, I would say, is definitely a life-changing experience.
Is that 50K?
No, it is a 74-mile race. Sean, the race director, changes it a little bit every year. So I think when I did it, it was 72 miles. He added a couple miles. But yeah, it is the first, it's what they call a golden ticket race. So the first two men and women to finish to place that Georgia Death Race get an automatic entry into Western States if they want to use it that year. And so I got second at the Georgia Death Race, so I got to go to Western States. So so that was one of the highlights. I've had a few. Pinhoti is another 100-miler over right over the state line in Alabama. Mm-hmm. It's on the Pinhoti Trail. It's a point to point, which is always like definitely like a new mental like challenge, you know. I kind of like the point to point, but Western States is also a point to point, but it's like basically you start one place and you end at a different place.
Okay.
So point to point race. And so it's definitely like a different, like it can give you a different mindset, a different approach to like just mentally, like you're trying to reach a destination. You're not looping back to where you once were, which is always like a little bit of like a mind game, at least for me, because every, you know, if you're doing like a loop race or an out and back, which is like probably the worst, is like every hill you're running down, you can't like quite enjoy it because, you know, you have to like go back and run back up it on the way back. But for a point to point, you don't have to do that. Like that mental barrier is kind of like, or at least for me, is kind of like broken down a little bit. Like you have like this destination that's different. And so Pinhoti 100 miler, that was probably the best 100 miler I've ever raced, like in terms of like my personal performance, like assessing my, like how I ran it.
Why is it, was it the best time or was it you stuck to the
strategy? It was my fastest time. And I just think it was just really well executed. I think Western States, I ran a good race, but I definitely had a few hiccups, a few low points. And in Pinhoti, I was pretty consistent just all day. I was just like mechanical, just like machine, like just like solid execution. I had a plan. I had my nutrition dialed. Like my stomach was good all day. That's the other thing that can go south a lot. And like when you're running for that long. So yeah, Pinhoti was probably my best executed race. So it gives me hope that I can, you know, maybe go back to Western States and like that field and like even, you know, pull together a better race than before someday. So yeah.
Can we take a step back for a second and talk about how your nutrition, the plant-based nutrition, how that changed your performance? And then if you don't mind, would you pick a race and just like take us through a little bit from the perspective of both how you approach it and, you know, like nutrition. And then also I'm curious to hear about your, what's going on in your head when you're running for 21 miles straight. I mean, for 21 hours straight.
Yeah. Okay. So first I'll talk nutrition. So the nutrition, how I like tangibly notice it changed my training and my running. Back when I started, within like a couple months, I noticed my recovery times were just like dramatically like faster. You know, the same workouts that I was doing, I was just recovering, you know, I could recover in like a day from like something and be running. I just had like this like pep in my step like the next day on like my recovery run that I just like never had before. So that was like, and I was just like, oh wow, like I'm getting in really good shape. But then like when I kind of like tried to like pinpoint, I was like, I like really changed my diet, you know? And I was eating like whole food, mostly whole foods and everything at that point too, and now as well. But and I had been eating mostly whole foods before that, but just with like chicken and stuff. And so I really do think it helped my recovery. And then the other thing I did is just like every day it was like in like the afternoon, and like everyone kind of talks about like the afternoon lull, like around like 2 or 3 o'clock, like after lunch, you just get like this like really sleepiness and just like exhausted and like kind of dragging the rest of the day. And like I would get that at school like all the time. And when I changed my diet and I stopped getting that, I would eat lunch and I'd be like, all right, yes, recharge, like let's go the rest of the day. And I never really, unless there was like, you know, something like to explain it, like, oh, I like pulled like at this deadline and I slept for 3 hours the night before. But unless like if I was doing everything like, you know, I normally did, like I just, and eating a plant-based diet, when I switched to that, I stopped getting that. And I just had so much more energy just like outside my workouts and runs. So like those were probably the things that I really noticed change for me personally.
And can you talk a little bit about the staples of your diet? Like what do you usually eat, breakfast, lunch, dinner, or kind of where are you most curious?
Yeah, I love like experimenting, exploring like different things. So I'm always kind of like changing and like tweaking little things. Now, let's see, for breakfast, I love having like an avocado toast on like sprouted green bread. I'm like, you know, standard millennial. So I'll have like, I'll load like some sprouted green toast with like, I'll load it with avocado. Like I love like just like putting like an entire avocado, like just fitting it on a piece of bread. Mm-hmm. And then I'll put like a little bit of like salt and chia seeds and sometimes like hemp seeds and pumpkin seeds on that. Mm-hmm. So it's like got this like nice like nutty like crunch and mm-hmm. like still has like that amazing avocado taste. And I love that avocados are so much cheaper in Georgia. It's amazing. That's what one of the things I loved about moving here. So avocados are like 50 cents now. So I'll do that. And then a lot of times I will also make a smoothie as well. So my standard smoothie, and this is kind of like my own recipe. I have like, I'll have like banana, some type of like berry. I'll put some like a handful of spinach or like kale or basically whatever greens I have laying around the house. And then I'll put coffee, and I've lately been loving doing the Ripple pea milk because that gives like a little extra protein and like DHA. I do like 2 tablespoons of chia seeds, 2 tablespoons of peanut butter. This is also a really great post-run smoothie.
That sounds
and then
amazing.
Maybe a little bit of juice if I'm feeling like something a little sweet. Like I'll put like a splash of like either orange juice or grapefruit juice. I love grapefruit juice as well. And then I'll blend that bad boy up into the Vitamix and bring it to work with me. So it's like my second breakfast kind of like. Mm-hmm. So that's a good recovery smoothie that I usually do. I usually do like if I'm doing a workout in the morning, I would do like my toast, and then I would go for my run, do my workout, and then I would like have my smoothie after. And then for lunch, I typically do like a grain salad of some kind is usually like my staple. I switch it up a lot, but typically I'll do like a quinoa grain salad. So I'll have like quinoa, like either load it with like arugula or spinach or kale, chard, like all that stuff, mix it up there. I'll do like some type of like dressing. I do a lot like lime cilantro vinaigrettes are really good. I'll put like whatever veggies I have in there. When I was hardcore training, I would do a lot of like roasted beets. So I would like roast beets in the oven and then I would like have them for the week. Mm-hmm. So I'd put those in there. They were really tasty in the grain salad. And then I load it with like toasted pumpkin seeds. If you have not discovered toasted pumpkin seeds, yeah, you need to. They go good on so well on everything. Like I put them on like everything, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. I put toasted pumpkin seeds with a little bit of olive oil and pink Himalayan salt pretty much on all my grain salads and salads. I might do like some dried cherries in there, maybe like a handful of blueberries, maybe like, I don't know. I don't eat like a lot of tofu. Sometimes I'll put like tofu in there. Sometimes I'll put, I don't know, like whatever. Like sometimes falafel will be really good in there, like mm-hmm. baked falafel. I love making falafel
dishes. Do you make your own
stuff? Yeah.
I'm going to have to get some recipes.
Yeah, we have several going right now. My husband really likes to fry them. I like them fried as well. I usually try to bake them to like reduce like, you know, some of the like oil, but sometimes you need like a little treat. So that those are always really good mm-hmm. as well. So that's typically what I do for lunch. And then dinner, oh man, pretty much go on Minimalist Baker website and you will find what I eat for dinner. I love her website. It is so, if you've never been on Minimalist Baker,
I love her.
It's like, all of her stuff is 10 ingredients or less, and they're not, like, super obscure ingredients. Like, I usually have pretty much everything around the house, especially if I've, like, planned for the week. They're, like, a lot of them are, like, one bowl. So there's, like, no, like one bowl for dishes, and a lot of them are, like, 30 minutes or less. And so I just have so many of her recipes we make for dinner. So
do you have any recent favorite that you tried? I think my favorite is that her Spanish quinoa stuffed peppers.
Oh my gosh, yes. We make those. Those are really good for recovery as well because of the like quinoa mm-hmm. and black beans and stuff in there. Yeah, we've made those a lot. Oh my gosh. What is the most recent? We made her She has a good cauliflower wing recipe that I really like.
It's baked. It's like a few different batters kind of, right? And then it has a cilantro, avocado.
Yes,
I love those too.
Yeah, those are really good. I haven't recently made those, but we recently did her cauliflower, her like spicy cauliflower tacos, and oh my gosh, my husband made them so spicy, and they were very spicy, but I think they have like 3/4 cup of like, maybe it's 1/3 cup of crushed red pepper, but they were really tasty and in the sauce. And but yeah, they were very spicy. But they were really good. That was probably the most recent thing we made from her.
I love it. I love how you are still like trying new things, and how, I mean, people think that plant-based vegan diet is so boring, and it's so not. There's so many options.
Yeah. And I'm like, I mean, I can cook, I can follow a recipe. I'm not like super creative myself, but I've been trying to explore like new people's like blogs, you know, because Minimalist Baker has like more of like, a lot of her stuff is more like a Hispanic type of like dish. So like I'm trying to like explore other avenues. Like I bought Rich Rolls and his wife put out the plant-based Italia. So I've been trying like some of those recipes. We made the gelato from there the other week. That was pretty good. I try to like explore like, you know, not only different dishes, but like different stuff people are putting out, because they can certainly cook better than I am. So if they've mastered something, I'm like, okay, I'm just going to do what you did. And then I might like, you know, adjust some things like nutritionally for myself. Like, oh, I need more like omegas this week, or like I want to add like beets to this for like you know, the like recovery aspect and that stuff. So, so it's fun. I really enjoy cooking, especially plant based cooking, and like
I love it.
Yeah.
All right, so while we're still on the topic of nutrition, can you share a few tricks of yours, if you have any? For example, as you mentioned, beets that are really good for recovery, or like some other maybe like specific components that you can sprinkle here and there in your nutrition to reach certain goals?
Yeah, from like an athletic perspective, you know, iron's very important to me. So the pumpkin seeds I talked about, they're very rich in iron. So, you know, they're delicious, and they're, you know, have all the, you know, have a lot of the nutrients that I seek from an athletic perspective. Let's see, chia seeds, I love them. You know, a complete protein, packed with omegas. Back to iron, I do a lot of like lentil-based stuff. So like red lentils are pretty rich in iron as well. As far as like protein and stuff, I mean, I really don't have any issues getting enough protein. I mean, you probably
where
have
like beat this horse at,
right. But I do love putting nut butters in like everything, you know, like desserts, snacks. Like I eat like a ton of nut butters. I love almond nut butter, peanut butters. You know, I've made walnut butter before. That delicious. Oh, I love walnuts as well. They're also packed with nutrients and omegas. Gosh, those are probably like my staples that come to like the forefront of my mind thinking
about
it.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
Now that's
the pea protein milk. Also, I really love. I've been loving that recently. Yeah.
Ripple. I still have.
I started drinking that last year. Oh, it's like the best plant-based milk in my opinion.
Yeah. I will definitely try
it. Aside from making your own nut milk, which I do sometimes, but the pea protein milk, the Ripple is really good. They also just came out with Greek yogurt.
Ripple did?
Yeah, Ripple did.
Oh, wow.
Pea protein Greek yogurt, which we just tried this week. It's also very good, so yeah.
Yeah, I'm headed to Whole Foods. Okay, so let's go back to your racing. And if you don't mind, can you pick whatever race that you would like to talk about? And I'm really curious about if there, like, take us through, like, if there are any rituals that you start with, kind of how you approach your nutrition game, as you said, like, or your strategy, you mentally, just a race day steps.
Yeah, let's see. So let's go to Western States, since that's like the one I've been talking about. So Western States, okay. So approaching the race nutritionally, I don't really like change a lot of things nutritionally going into a race. I mean, I have what has worked for me all through training, and then basically leading up to something like 100 mile race at Western States, like I'm tapering off, like I'm running less miles, right? But I'm basically eating the same amount. So I'm kind of like, my body's like loading and up on all of the stuff from like all the training I just put in, and I'm able to recover more, and I'm getting kind of like more of a positive caloric balance going into the race. So I really don't need to like eat more or like carb load or like do anything like, you know, unusual diet wise.
Let me just make clarify yeah. So to make sure I understand correctly. So you're saying you continue with the same nutrition regimen, but you run less miles prior to the race.
Exactly.
So that there is that surplus of the nutrients that come into your body. Got it.
Okay. Yep. So basically I put in all this work. Yeah, I put in all this work and I was like eating a certain amount. And then I don't stop running, but I run significantly less, especially like the week going into the race. But I try to keep eating the same amount because my body is still like, you know, we're hungry. We're like recovering from all that stuff we did, and we don't know what you're going to do next. So we're going to be ready for it. And what happens is your muscles kind of top off all the glycogen stores. So like there's carbohydrate stores in the muscle that are depleted, you know, when you're really pushing yourself in training and intensity and hard workouts. Once you cut back on the volume, your muscles are sensitive to that from the training and want to basically pack your muscles with glycogen. So that's kind of what they're doing. And so I'll actually gain like a couple of pounds, and it's usually in like glycogen and like kind of like the water that follows with that into the muscles, like just in the week leading up to the race. It's kind of freaky, like if you get on the scale and like, oh my gosh, like I'm so much heavier, but it's really just that your muscles aren't topping off the glycogen, and that water kind of follows the glycogen as well. But I don't do a lot in terms of like carb loading. I do really love sweet potatoes. I kind of like eat them all through training as well. But I might make sure I eat like something more like potatoes like the day before that are a little more low in fiber, because I normally eat, my diet's pretty high in fiber. The day before you run a race, you probably don't want to be loading up on fiber because you could have some GI issues and distress, especially in like 100 mile or something that long, you're going to be running all day. Mm-hmm. And so I'll usually just, that's pretty much the big thing I'll do is I'll really like watch my fiber intake,
okay,
like the day and a half before.
So what it looks like, you would eat like more nut butters maybe, or more like fatty foods that don't have as much fiber, more like nutritionally dense?
Yeah, I would eat probably more, really like potatoes are really good. I love like baked sweet potatoes. So like the night before Western States, I had, I think this is a Minimalist Baker as well. It's a Mediterranean baked sweet potato. So it's literally like a sweet potato with like toasted and I think like cumin seasoned chickpeas, and I think there's like a tahini dressing and cilantro and yeah tomato and something. So like a lot of it is carbohydrate based, like whole foods carbohydrate based, and doesn't have like a ton of fiber in it. And so I just find that works well for me personally, like going into a race is just eat normally, watch the fiber. You know, don't do anything crazy running wise. Really, it's about, like, for me, it's about, like, okay, don't go running 10 miles this morning. We're going to run 4 miles. Four. That's it. Then we're going to stop. And then we're going to eat breakfast the same way we always do. So that's kind of what I found that works for me.
Okay.
I forget if there were other parts of your question.
No, that's all. So now the day of the race, what's happening?
Oh, yeah. In terms of nutrition or, like...
Let's start with nutrition.
Okay. So nutrition. So it kind of depends on how far the race is. For something like 100 miles, I want to make sure I'm pretty, not like full going into it, like stomach-wise, but I want to be satiated. Like, you do not want to stand on the start of a 100-mile race hungry. It's not a good thing, because you are going to be running for the next, like, 20-ish plus, maybe, hours. And so I try to eat something that's a little more filling for breakfast than I normally would. So for, like, shorter distance races, so for Western States, I had... like, I think I had oatmeal with nut butter and blueberries and maybe a little, like, maple syrup in there, and probably, like, some chia seeds or something, black coffee every morning, and, Yeah, and maybe like a banana or something. Mm-hmm. So oatmeal, you know, eat it for breakfast. You're not hungry till dinner, right? So that I have found that oatmeal has worked pretty well for me for hundreds.
Does that still apply if not hungry until dinner? Does that still apply if you're running?
it definitely keeps you fuller for longer. But yeah, I probably wouldn't be hungry till lunch. I wouldn't get that like 10 a.m. like, oh, I need another snack.
Right.
But for something like a marathon, I'll probably do something more light, like a black coffee and like a piece of toast with like nut butter and like a banana or something, like something that's a little more light and that, because like, and when you're running 100 miles, obviously you're running at like a much lower intensity than you're going to be running, you know, a race that's going to take you 3 hours, like a marathon versus a race that's going to take you 20 hours. So when you're running at a lower intensity, not as much blood is diverted away from your GI tract. So you are like going to be able to digest that food like as you're running the beginning part of the race, whereas like if you're running a 5K, for example, you don't want to be full start. At least I don't want to be full standing on the start line of a 5K, you know, because but you want to eat something for sure. If you're racing, you should definitely eat something. I tell the athletes that I coach, like you need breakfast is mandatory before this workout, and breakfast is mandatory before any race, just because why would you start a race with low blood sugar? You know, it doesn't make sense. Like, that's what you're burning in the race. Like,
I think that's what I definitely need to work on, because again, like the longest that I've done, and again, I'm not like a prolific runner by any means, but the longest I've done was 15 miles, and I have a really hard time eating before I run, so I usually run an empty stomach, and it seems to serve me better at the beginning, but then I don't know if I'm getting the best performance because I do get pretty disoriented by the end of it.
The science will tell you you're not getting the best performance as well. No, you definitely, you just need to find something that works well. Like, I mean, before like a hard like road race, like half marathon that I want to like run really fast or marathon, I'll make sure I'm done eating for like 2 hours before the race. So it might be a matter of like maybe you're not eating early enough, like maybe like you just don't feel like, a lot of times when people wake up, like if they're not used to eating breakfast or maybe they have nerves or whatever for the race, they just don't feel like eating. Still eat. But yeah, that's the other thing. Like for timing, I'll also time it a little like closer to the race start in a 100-mile race. Like I might like stop eating like an hour before the race start, whereas like a marathon or half marathon or something, I might stop eating like 2.5 hours before that race start, just because you want to make sure you're pretty digested and your stomach's pretty clear, but you still want that like those carbohydrates and that blood sugar, your blood sugar levels up, because when you wake up in the morning, your blood sugar is pretty low. So
and then how do you approach refueling during 100 mile?
Oh yeah, that's the popular question everyone wants to know. So if you ask this question to like 10 different 100-mile runners, you are going to get so many different answers. So I'm going to tell you what works for me.
Okay.
And this is what I tell people who ask me this, who are like interested in or like exploring like ultra running and stuff, like, ooh, what do I eat? Like really, like eat whatever you're not going to puke back up. That is what you should eat. Eat whatever stays down and doesn't make you feel sick. You found it. And honestly, like it's constantly evolving like during the race, like there's stuff that like I ate at Pinhoni that just like didn't agree with me at Western States, probably because it was 110 degrees, you know, like, and your stomach gets more upset and like the heat. So that's the other thing, like heat will affect like what I'm eating in the 100 mile race. Obviously the distance will affect what you're eating. You don't really have to eat like a taco in a marathon, but I will eat a taco in a 100 mile race, you know? So anyway, tacos. I really like eating tacos on 100 milers. I mean, the 100 is really like where I'm eating like the most solid food. I like doing avocado tacos with like lime and sea salt wrapped in like a corn tortilla. It's just like very refreshing after I drink Tailwind, which is like it's like a drink formula. That is, mostly like just like sugars. It's like Gatorade, but it's like much better than Gatorade, especially if you don't want to be like puking, like, you know, a few hours later. Gatorade is just too much like simple sugar, and like they don't they don't manufacture it for people who are going to be out there all day running. So Tailwind, I use their product. It's a really good product. It is like sweet. It's not as sweet as like Gatorade, but I find that like eating tacos like at the aid stations really helps cut like the sweetness that like you're getting like all this like sweet stuff. So I'm just really careful on like not overloading my system with like sweet stuff, just because I find, probably just because I don't eat a lot of it like in my normal everyday routine, that like I just can't like, you know, bombard my system with it on race day. So I try to be a little conscious of that, but I'll eat that. You know, peanut butter and jelly sandwiches and stuff have worked well for me in the past. Honestly, like, a cup of Coke, like cold Coke. I never drink soda ever, but like cold Coca-Cola when you're running like a really hot like ultra marathon, like 100 miler, can like just really hit the spot. It's got like a little bit of caffeine, and like some like the carbonation can sometimes be kind of soothing for like your stomach. Ginger chews are always a like good thing, especially if your stomach starts feeling a little like iffy. I love Trader Joe's ginger chews. They're like really, really gingery. They don't taste quite as sweet. They taste more like ginger spicy. Gosh, what else? Sometimes I'll do just like basically I'll kind of like sometimes look at the spread at an aid station and like, you know, potato chips will look good. So I'll eat like a handful of potato chips, you know, like pretty much anything.
Do you like stop and eat or do you like continue run? I just can't fathom.
Yeah, this is not like a road race. Yeah. So for like a taco, basically what happens when you roll for like a 100 miler or something, you roll into the aid station, like I'll be wearing like a hydration pack that has like either like bottles or like a bladder, and like my crew will be like either refilling that or getting me my new vest that's like all loaded with like new food and like whatever I was eating. I might like look at like the food either that my crew has out or that like the aid station has like on the table, and typically it's like peanut butter and jelly and chips, candy. They have a lot of times they have soda, ginger ale, Coke, that type of thing, and I'll just like eat whatever kind of like feels good. And so I am a really, really quick like in and out of the aid station goer, so I won't spend, I mean if I spend a whole minute at an aid station, that was like a really long time for me. But pretty much it's like as soon as my hydration pack's ready to go, I might take like the taco to go, and I'll either like, you know, like run while I'm eating the taco, or like I might like walk out of the aid station, like keep moving forward with the taco, and then like, you know, run as I like finish it or something. Like I'm pretty like efficient going in. Some people will actually like sit down and like eat for like a few minutes, or like stand there and like eat for a few minutes and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Watermelon can be really good too. I should say there's this company called Mirror Energy that makes these like nut butter gels that are like nut butter. Well, they make nut butter gels, and they make just like fruit gels, and they're made out of like real like whole food. And the nut butter ones are like, they have like almond butter, cashew butter, and hazelnut butter ones, and they put a little bit of molasses in it, which is like a lower glycemic like sweetener, which is really good. And also has iron in it as well. So those are kind of like nice that they're not just like sugar, like empty calories. You're actually getting some like nutrients in them, especially using them for training. And then they have like the fruit-based ones. They have like these red raspberry ones that they literally just take raspberries and they just like grind them up and like put like a little bit of like the molasses and like sea salt and like magnesium, like stuff like the electrolytes in there that you're losing, and replenish that. And they taste like more tart than they are like sweet. Mm-hmm. They even have like a sweet potato one. They have like a blackberry one. So yeah, I've been liking eating those as well, because they're kind of like more like whole food, but like they call them gels. They're kind of like, I don't know what you would call them, but they're not like your standard gel.
Yeah.
So
I think what I love about you is that we're talking about a 100-mile race, and you're still able to talk about like refueling during a 100-mile race with a smile on your face, and able to like pick up on the joy that you're still able to get through like snacking through running a 100-mile in 100-degree weather. This is so amazing. Just like what do you think it is that allows you to keep that mindset and that perspective and the smile on your face while you do all that?
should run 100 miles and you'll find out for yourself.
I certainly will now.
I don't know. It's like, I mean, there's certainly parts that, I mean, the whole thing is like, it's hard, you know, like it's a hard thing to do to run 100 miles. Like no matter how fast, no matter how slow you're running, like it's 100 miles. Like that is not easy. And there's just something very like rewarding about doing something that's hard, you know,
yeah.
And just like pushing your limits. And I don't know. So I guess that's why I kind of like look back on it. Like you can always look back. It's easier to look back on it and be like, oh, that was such a great time. Remember that time I was like puking in the bushes? Like, yeah. You know, my stomach was like awful. But yeah, no. I love it. And like a lot of people will say that running something like a 100 miler is like a glorified eating and drinking contest because you have to eat when you run 100 miles. When you run really like anything over a marathon, like if you aren't eating something, you are not going to do well. Like you probably for 100 miles, like you're not going to finish if you can't take in calories. Like you just literally won't. Like you will go hypoglycemic and you'll fade and you will stop. Your body will you'll stop running. But if you can just like keep taking in like you know nutrition and calories, electrolytes, fluids, like you can go forever. You know?
Forever.
So, yeah. Really, I mean, we don't even know how far we can go. Like, pretty much, like, the thing that probably, like, limits me the most, I've never tried running more than 102 miles was the furthest race I ran. The thing that I think would limit me the most from going further is the sleep thing, mm-hmm. You know? Because you are running through the whole night and, like, in 100 miles and, and so once you really start cutting into the sleep, I think that would probably stop a human much before, like, they're just, like, you know, totally depleted from, like, nutrition or something like that. They would need to sleep before they would, you know, do that, so.
That is incredible. What is, what are some of the maybe most profound experience, like, emotional or mentally that you can think of that you had through some of the races that you did?
Profound experience. Well, I ran into a bear one time. That was that was quite an experience. I was running down the trail, but you were probably looking for something a little more like insightful than that.
No, this is actually really cool. I love that. I don't think you can do that.
Yeah, no, that was actually fun because it was like, looking back, it was fun. I was running down this trail and there was this big like black bear in the middle of the trail. And I think we both scared the daylights out of each other because, like, I, like, screamed and I did the thing you're not supposed to do when you see a black bear, which is, like, basically run away. You're supposed to, like, act really big and, like, put your arms up and even, like, if they, like, don't go away, like, start throwing rocks at it, like, just make yourself look, like, scary and, like, threatening. And black bears are nice and they're vegetarian, mostly, and they, like, won't really want to mess with you, and they, you know, when they have a cub, they're a little more, like, defensive and territorial, but, yeah, I just ran back and looked for, like, runners behind me, like, to cross the trail, and the bear just ran through in the woods, like, it wanted nothing to do with me, but, yeah, that was funny, because I was like, oh, like, we scared each other, and, you know, poor bear. I you know, this is, like, its home. I'm just, like, out for a run, like, in the middle of, like, Virginia, you know. It's like,
that's
bear
funny.
Is like, what in the heck is this human doing out here?
That's funny.
So,
have you ever experienced any challenges from maybe, like, other people either looking down on you or, like, some of the resistance because you are plant-based or you're a woman in endurance running? And which one is harder? Which one is your experience more of the resistance because of?
Yeah, I mean, in ultra running, like, there are a lot of people who are plant-based and do really well. So I think, like, my results kind of, like, have spoken for themselves. Like, I get a lot more people asking me about, like, what I'm eating because they want to eat the same way than I do people being, like, oh, you really needed a steak because, like, that would make you, like, perform better. Because, I don't know, I feel like I don't know, your results can kind of speak for themselves. Mm-hmm. Like, you're training and performing at a very high level. Like, clearly I'm not really, like, deficient in anything that I need. And, like, a Whole Foods plant-based diet has supplied me with everything that I need to train and recover and, you know, perform well and put out, you know, solid efforts. Mm-hmm. And, you know, really be at a very competitive level. So I think I get, fortunately, I get a lot more of that. And I think, like, the ultra running community, that I obviously, like, there's a lot of people, you know, Scott Jurek, who really, like, motivated me to, you know, educate myself and go plant-based, you know, so it's not like I'm, like, the first person doing this. So I think that has really helped. So I'm sure Scott probably got a lot more of that
right
back in the day before me. And as a woman, I mean, there are definitely, like, some comments that have been made that were, you know, a little sexist at times, especially, and I've noticed it a little bit more, like, running, like, more in, like, when I'm running, like, outside the city, like, in the South and stuff, and usually it's not even, like, runners, it's usually, like, people out there, you know, in the woods, or, like, usually people, like, driving by or something in their car if I'm, like, having to run on the road, like, something like that. But, you know, for the most part, like, I mean, especially the trail running community is just very welcoming and encouraging and just very, like, empowering. I mean, there are so many, like, awesome women out there who are doing the same thing and more than I am, and, you know, they're just so inspirational to me, and, you know, I have women contacting me, telling me I'm inspirational for them, which is just really awesome.
Well, you definitely are an inspiration for me.
Oh, yeah, thank you. Yeah, so I think I am happy to say that I really do think that, like, from those two, like perspectives, I get a lot more of, like, curiosity and, like, inspirational, mm-hmm. like, than I do, like, the negative stuff. So, yeah.
I have another question. I know I kind of asked you before that if that's okay for us to talk about. But I'm curious. I know there is a lot of, I guess, curiosity or maybe awareness from women who are thinking about doing endurance sports and doing the plant-based diet and concerns about them starting missing their periods or just in general what the implications are on the woman's body from both the hardcore exercising as well as the plant-based diets. Can you talk a little bit about that? If you had any experience with that, if you had maybe others express concern to you, and how, what are some of the suggestions perhaps that you may have?
Yeah, well, firstly, I really, I don't think it should be a concern. I think that this is a really important topic to talk about. I don't think that being plant-based should cause anyone concern for that. Like, you know, you can clearly get plenty of nutrients, energy, calories, everything that you need. So that should not be a concern at all. From my own experience, I can say when I was in grad school, probably like 3 years into grad school, I started training, like, and competing at a little more, like, competitive level. I increased my weekly mileage. I was running, went from running like 50 miles a week to running like 80 or so miles a week. So I was training a lot more, and I've never had, like, an eating disorder or anything, but, like, there was a point in time where I think that I increased my mileage and my training volume, but I didn't increase the amount that I was eating enough. And so I did lose a little bit of weight. I probably lost like 8 pounds or so. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, oh, I'm just training more, like, whatever. And I wasn't, like, ever really, like, starving, but I just didn't, like, I was like, oh, this is, like, the amount I'm, like, used to eating. So I just wouldn't give myself more, even if I was, like, I could have eaten more, you know what I mean? And so basically I think I just wasn't fueling enough, like, in terms of volume. And I did have a period of time where I, you know, had amenorrhea, didn't get my period. And Long story short, that basically ended with me getting a stress fracture, not surprisingly, because that's usually what happens, you know, when your hormone cycle as a woman protects you and your bone health mm-hmm. from, you know, getting stress fracture and helps your bone rebuild and turn over and everything. So when you're not getting those cycles of estrogen and progesterone, it puts you at very high risk for bone injuries. And so it's really important as a female athlete that you are, you know, getting a regular cycle. And I think that I didn't really, I mean, from a science perspective, I knew that, but it's kind of tough because you never think it applies to you until it happens to you,
right.
You know? And so anyway, I ended up getting a stress fracture, and then of course I couldn't run for a couple months, and I, you know, started cycling, got my cycle back pretty immediately, because it was really just like a training volume mm-hmm. mismatch with like the amount of food I was eating. And at that point I was like, okay, like I need to figure out what happened and I need to make a change. And I did. And I just started eating basically the same thing I was eating, but I just started eating more. And I eventually, like, you know, I did a slow progression coming back from the injury, but I eventually got back to where I was, you know, training before, like my 80 miles a week and like high intensity workouts and stuff, but I was just fueling more for it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was at a little bit higher weight as well. I was like 5 or 8 pounds, like I had gained that back.
Mm-hmm.
And I was running faster, I was recovering better. And I had a totally normal cycle. And so
mm-hmm.
that, ever since then, I've never had any issues with it. I've never had another bony injury or even like serious injury, very fortunately. Like I'm actually I consider myself a pretty durable runner, like knock on wood. Like everyone gets injured if you run enough of this stuff. But
mm-hmm.
I have a pretty durable body, fortunately, but and I think I'm also, part of it is that I do strength training and I'm pretty smart and like regimented with like my training loads and stuff and
mm-hmm.
and nutrition as well. But I think that was a big wake up call for me. But I think that really it's just about making sure you're fueling enough. Like I really don't think that, like I fully believe that women are capable competing at the highest level, you know, 80 miles a week, 100 miles a week, 120 miles a week. We just need to be really conscious of how we're fueling. I mean, men need to do this too. But obviously for women, it just manifests itself in a different manner. And so I think that really it comes down to just making sure that you're getting enough in
mm-hmm.
to your system, that you're able to recover between those bouts. And even now, like, I mean, you know, before this whole thing happened, I was running like, I think I was running like 100 miles a week and training at a pretty high level and, you know, getting my cycle totally normally
mm-hmm.
and regularly and just feeling great. So, and obviously, like, you know, my reproductive health is pretty on point, apparently, so we found out.
I love it. And
so,
I want to talk about
yeah.
it in just a second. Since you mentioned the strength training, can you give me an idea of what does it look like for you, the strength training part?
Yeah, so I strength train. It kind of depends a little bit where I am at in my training cycle, but I typically strength train about twice a week.
Mm-hmm.
I do a lot of, like, heavy weight, lower body stuff. So that what that looks like is like a lot of like weighted squats, lunges, deadlifts, weighted calf raises. I love, and I think I'm a firm believer that, you know, as a physical therapist as well, I really believe that strength training is just a mandatory component of every runner's routine. Like, you don't have time, don't run that extra 3 miles and take that half an hour and just like pick up something heavy
mm-hmm.
because it's gonna ultimately help you to run like more. You
right.
know, you're not gonna be sidelined with an injury. And it's not just about gaining strength, right? It's about, you know, when I deadlift 150 pounds, you know, obviously I'm picking up a heavy weight, my muscles are working hard, I'm getting that strength training aspect, I'm gonna gain strength from that, but I'm also loading the bones and the tendons with that weight. And that's heavier weight than what they see when I'm running. You know, running, they're going to see a lot of heavy load. They're going to see a lot of high impact. So I really need to, like, get them to get my bones and tendons to, and not just my muscles, to rebuild and adapt and become durable to handle the loads that I'm putting on them in training and running. And they respond very differently to heavy strength training than they do running that extra 3 miles, right? So just scientifically, like, it makes sense, like, biologically, why this should work. And there's data to actually support that. Strength training is, if there's anything you can do to prevent or reduce your risk for injury running, it's picking up heavy stuff with good mechanics, of course. But
I can't, with your background, you're such an amazing, just vast pool of information on so many different subjects. Do you do coaching? You mentioned that you coach.
Yeah, I coach like a small handful of people. I really enjoy it. I really try to make sure that, like, my training approach and philosophy line up with you know, what people's goals are, what their own philosophies and approaches are, and like, if someone isn't a good match, or I think that they would be a good match with another coach, I'll, you know, happily refer them. But yeah, I do work with, you know, some people that.
That's amazing. Okay, now let's talk about the most exciting subject that you're expecting.
Oh my yes.
So, congratulations, first of all, and this is so cool. But you're such a rock star with the way, like, I mean, you're still running, you're still active, you're still doing all of these things. So, and can you talk a little bit about kind of your approach, if there are any changes in your daily routines of how you're approaching your training and your nutrition, and then also address any concerns that listeners may have about being pregnant while eating a plant-based diet?
Yeah, so I will say that when I found out I was pregnant, it was a little bit of a surprise. It was a lot of bit of a surprise because I was in the middle of training for Western States this year,
which
I didn't get to run because of that. But yeah, I was in the middle of running like 100-mile weeks. I was feeling amazing. What happened was I ran the Atlanta Marathon, and I felt great the whole time. And Atlanta Marathon is a very, very challenging road marathon. It's got like 3,000 feet of elevation change or something, which is like a lot for a road marathon. Like, it's a very hilly road marathon. And I ran it as a training race for Western States, and I ended up running my fastest marathon time by about like a minute, but on like a very, like, you know, hilly course. And I was treating it as like a training run. So anyway, felt like I was primed up for like Western States and really in good shape. But after that race, I just like wasn't recovering like how I felt like I should, and it wasn't really like explained. And I was like, well, I didn't feel like I pushed myself that hard. Like, it was crazy. And then a week later, I found out I was pregnant, and that had explained, like, oh, why am I not recovering from this, like, marathon effort? Like, so that was a surprise, but we were very excited. And so that was when I found out. That was, you know, back in March. And so let's see. So basically, after that, really, I just reassessed, you know, all my goals, and have really just adapted all my goals. Like, I was, you know, obviously I was planning to run Western States. I was not going to run Western States 4.5 months pregnant. I mean, we talked about the conditions a bit. The heat is very concerning. The heat is definitely more concerning than even like the running itself would have been. If I went back to Western States, I wanted to be competitive as well. And so, yeah, it's been kind of nice because I don't really have an agenda right now, you know? Like, this is like the first time in several years that I don't have like tempo runs and interval workouts on my like schedule, and like I'll just basically go for a run just to like enjoy running, which is like, I enjoy running most of the time, I guess. But it's just nice to have that like freedom and just flexibility.
Yeah.
And And yeah, just like really like taking like the time to enjoy it. So I'm still running. It's got, the miles are not getting easier, but they're still enjoyable. I ran a 9-mile trail race this morning, and that was really fun for most of it. I'm usually, right now, I was like, after I found out in morning sickness hurt, I was running like 50 miles a week, and now I'm running about 35-ish miles a week, and just like really enjoying it. Mm-hmm. You know, having time to do like some other stuff that I didn't get to do when I was running like 80 to 100 miles a week, like going to yoga, and like I'm still strength training as well. Okay. I just have like adapted that as well, like doing more single leg stuff, taking like some pressure off the pelvic floor. Mm-hmm. All of that. But yeah, really my plan is just to like keep running as long as it feels good and I feel good. I haven't had any like mechanical, like big musculoskeletal like problems. So like, I think if I did, I know some women have like a lot of pelvic pain, low back pain. I haven't really had any of that. So I'm just gonna, my plan right now is just keep running while it's still enjoyable, and hopefully it'll be up to the due date, but I have no idea. I've never done this before. So, and then really importantly, obviously, it's really taking my time coming back. Like, I don't have any races on the calendar after she's born. So I really just want to, like, take my time coming back to, like, making sure, like, all the systems are in check. I don't want to, like, you know, be trying to race, like, a couple months later.
Right.
So that's kind of my approach to it, like, what I'm doing now. Mm-hmm. So.
What about nutrition? Have you changed anything from the nutrition perspective?
Yeah, it's actually really funny. So, you know, like I said, this was a bit of a surprise for us. So normally I'm, like, the type of person who likes to be very prepared for like monumental things in their life, and like, you know, I would have probably we had wanted to have a family, we just like, you know, we're thinking differently in terms of timing with everything. Yeah. But nutrition part. So I would have liked to have done like 6 months of reading on how to be a pregnant person before actually trying to become a pregnant person. So anyway, I didn't get to do that. So I just started like, you know, trying to find all this information, like, oh my gosh, like what do I, you know, what should I be eating? What should I be, you know, prenatals? Oh my gosh, like I'm like, you know, 6 weeks pregnant. I haven't taken a single prenatal vitamin. I was supposed to be taking these 4 months ago, you know? So yeah, there was a little bit of panic, but then I started like reading up on everything, and I'm like, oh my gosh, like I'm already eating all of this stuff. Like all the stuff that you're supposed to eat when you're pregnant are just like good, healthy, whole plant-based foods that like I'm already eating now to like fuel my body to like, you know, perform and like recover and train at a high level, mm-hmm. you know, like iron in the pumpkin seeds, like protein, like complete protein, like DHA, omega-3s, like folate even, like pumpkin seeds are rich in folate. Like, who knew? Sunflower seeds. I eat a ton of those. They're really rich in folate, too. Like, so it was just, like, I was immediately just, like, oh, like, I'm already getting, like, all of this stuff. And I did start taking a prenatal because, like, you know, whatever. Like, it's probably not going to hurt me. But, like, I mean, I was, and my baby is, like, very healthy. And I was so, like, concerned, like, oh, neural tube defect. So, anyways, that was, like, I just say that because, it was almost like funny, like that I just was like, oh, I'm like literally already doing all of this stuff. This is just like stuff that like humans should be eating for health, you know?
Yeah.
It just so happens that like when you're pregnant, now another human being is depending on everything that you put in your body. So now it's like people, you know, feel like, okay, now it like really counts, and it does. So that's like really good if that's like what motivates people to like start eating, mm-hmm. you know, whole foods and plants that are really nutrient dense and everything. So yeah, honestly, to be honest with you, I really do not eat that differently now. I mean, I had my whole like morning sickness thing that was hard to eat anything for a while, but after I got over that, I'm pretty much eating like normally, and it's delicious and amazing. I'm eating like less because of like my stomach's all like squished up now, and your GI system, like there's a lot of stuff that happens when you're pregnant that they don't tell you about. But yeah, one is like, you know, your digestive system.
The real
really
estate
slows.
Changes.
Yeah, yeah. The real estate changes. Someone's taking over in there, and your stomach gets smaller, more condensed, and acid reflux is a thing I've never had before. Now I have it all the time.
That is really
yeah,
cool.
But yeah, and your GI tract just slows down. Like I'm used to just like burning through my meals in a couple hours and being hungry again. Mm-hmm. Not when I'm pregnant. Like, I mean, obviously I'm running a lot less, but yeah, I'll be full for like so long. I'm like, oh my gosh, like I want to eat again. When am I going to be hungry again? Yeah. So that has definitely been really like, you know, like a change of pace for me, like in terms of like eating. But yeah, I'm really not eating that differently. But I will say that a good person to follow on Instagram is Ellen Fisher. Do you follow her?
No.
Okay, yeah, follow Ellen Fisher. She's not a runner, but she is a vegan, and she has like these three like children. She lives in like Hawaii with her husband, and she has these three children. And they're like adorable. Two are boys, and she literally just had like one little baby girl, another little baby girl, and she's all vegan, and she posts like recipes and like YouTube videos, and
I'll definitely do that.
She's a very strong advocate for like, you know, vegan, like plant based, like whole foods, like diet and like family, and like I just really love her. You'll like following her. So I would recommend following her because she is just like, you know, the queen in terms of like vegan mama, you know, and her boys and little baby are just like adorable. And like she posts pictures of them like eating like just like papayas and like they just like love it, you know. These kids are just growing up like a papaya is like a treat, you know, that's like candy. And I just think that's like amazing. And, you know, that like, you know, kids don't need like, you know, Skittles and like fruit is like good, and like, you know, whole plant based foods are good. And I'm sure my kid will have like cake and stuff at some point, but like, you know, like it's just she's a really good one to follow. So I've enjoyed kind of following her, especially since starting the pregnancy journey.
I love it. I'm sure you're gonna be just as much of inspiration to others as she is. are there any tips or any pieces of advice that you can share with listeners if somebody's on the edge or kind of they maybe want to get into some endurance running, or maybe they want to take a leap and go transition to more of a plant-based diet, but they're a little bit hesitant or they don't know where to start? What would you say to them, or what would be some of the takeaways from them that they can implement?
Yeah, I'd say just do it. Just like take the leap, just challenge yourself. If you want to get into more like long distance running, I mean, like just go hang out. I mean, a great thing to do is just like volunteer at a trail race, preferably an ultra, and just like go hang out in the aid station and like watch people coming through. And it's like amazing. Like everyone has their own journey and their own story about how they got there. And like, it's so incredible. Like, especially in like the ultra community, just like listening to people. And I mean, watch the front runners coming through, watch the very last person. I mean, I volunteered at Georgia Death Race this year, and like, I'll never forget like the very last woman before the cutoff. I think I was at mile, I was Jake Bull, so I think it was mile like 46 or something like that. But anyway, like the very last woman to come through before the cutoff, oh my gosh, she was just like, she was so inspirational because she, like, it was, like, dark, right? It was, like the sun had gone down, like, it's pitch black, and she was, like, running down this gravel road, and I was, like, yelling at her, like, you know, you've got, like, 3 minutes, like, 3 minutes before the cutoff, and she just, like, started sprinting and just, like, to, like, make this cutoff, and she's, like, the very last person, and just, like, seeing how hard she was trying and how, like, much she was pushing herself was just, like, oh, my gosh, like, these people are, like, they're pushing themselves just as hard as I'm pushing myself, like, you know, at the front. And, like, you know, it was just, like, so moving. And, like, and then, like, helped her, like, get her stuff ready and, like, get out before the cutoff. And, like, she was, like, practically crying. You know, and I looked at the results. She ended up finishing, you know. And I don't know. It was just, you know, just go, like, watch it and, like, see if that does something to you. And if it does, then, you know, try it yourself. you know.
I love it. I love it. It's such a cool story. Yeah. It's like, it doesn't matter where you stand in comparison to others. It's about what it means to you and where you're at in your own journey. Mm-hmm. That's really cool. Okay, so, well, I always finish with a question of kind of what kindness means to people and how they get to follow it in their daily life. Would you share a little bit about what kindness means to you?
Yeah, what kindness means to me. I think really for me, when I think about kindness, it comes down to just treating other people the way you want to be treated yourself. You know, like we were talking about this, like everyone has their own story and everyone has their own demons that they're fighting. And we don't know, you know, you don't know someone's story until you really like talk to them and like figure it out. And I just think that, I don't know, like, I think if we gave each other, like, the benefit of the doubt more often, like, just in everyday life, like, someone cuts you off in traffic, like, they're probably not trying to be a jerk, you know, probably, like, I don't know, just, like, giving each other the benefit of the doubt and, like, just knowing that each person has their own stories and each person is going through, like, their own challenges in life and, yeah, and then just, like, treating them like you would want them to treat you.
Yeah.
So that's kind of what kindness means to me.
I love that. Well, thank you so much for your time. Yeah. I know it took tons of your time, but thank you so much. And for everything you do, you're so full of light and the way you talk about everything from veganism and plant-based diet to endurance training to all your science feedback and all the other amazing things that you've done or that are coming up for you. You're just like, you're just a shining light and you have a smile on your face about regardless what you talk about. So I thank you for that. And I cannot wait to see where it takes you on your, with your pregnancy and your motherhood that's upcoming, but then also with all your endurance racing and all of the research. So I'm just very thankful that our paths have crossed and I cannot wait to see where you go. And if the listeners want to find you, what's the best place for them to follow you?
Probably Instagram. I'm the most active. And my Instagram handle is J_Palm_. Mm-hmm. And I'm also on Facebook, Jackie Merritt. And I'm on Twitter, but I'm a really bad tweeter, so you can follow me. You get a tweet every month or so. I think I'm PalmerJA17231, I think is my Twitter.
Sounds good, and I'll include those in the show notes as well. Well, thank you so much, Jackie.
Yeah, thank you.
For more information, you can go to followyourkind.com or follow me on Instagram @kindchristina. Please also subscribe to the show and give me a good review. Thanks for stopping by.